You're listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voices of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond, grassroots, listener-supported, solar-powered radio, broadcasting live from the Cultural District in sunny Fairfield, Iowa, on our solar-powered power. And this is Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my... not my co-host. Normally with me it would be my mother, Caroline Kilborn, and she's not able to be with us today. But we do have a really fascinating guest with us today. Kayla Kagan is a writer and playwright. She received her BFA in theater from Stephen F. Austin University. She lives in Los Angeles. And this is her first book. It's called Piper Parish. It's a young adult novel. It's getting a lot of buzz. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Kayla.
Hi, thanks. I'm so happy to be here today. I'm sorry. I'm glad to talk with you.
Yeah, she's, you know, mom's in her 80s, so sometimes she doesn't, and she lives about 25 miles down the road, so every now and then she needs to take a break. So, Kayla, Stephen F. Austin University, that sounds like it must be in Texas.
It is. It's in East Texas. Texas, as Texans like to tell you, is definitely a very big state, and it's in the East Texas area, so even people in West Texas may not know of it, or North Texas. It's a state university, and I went there for my undergrad and did my theater work there and my writing training there, and I had a really good time. It's in the oldest town in Texas. It's called Nacogdoches, Texas.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Did you grow up in Texas?
Sorry?
Did you grow up in Texas?
I did. I grew up in Houston.
I kind of figured that perhaps you did.
I went to school in East Texas, but it just turned into that.
Well, Piper Parish is, like I mentioned, a young adult novel. It's about this young woman, Piper, who is an artist in Houston in high school. And she can't wait to get out and get to New York City and go to art school in New York City. And I'm wondering, how autobiographical is this for you in that sense?
Question I get the most. And I love talking about it. So, you know, people are often told when you're writing, especially when you're a new writer, you know, write about what you know. And the two places I know the most are New York and Texas. So I definitely have to say that Piper's drive to get to New York and know New York while living in Texas is something I definitely identify with. For me, I was a theater student, and I was at the time, when you wanted to train and study in theater, you went to New York. You didn't go anywhere else really in the country. And I knew that I wanted Piper to have this desire to want to study art, and because she was not only an excelling artist, but she was actually going to be professional, and she's at that level of being that gifted and that good. So she really wanted to train where she thought the best teachers were at this particular fictional conservatory, kind of loosely based on like Juilliard or the New School or School of Visual Arts. So I could connect with Piper's location of where she was, location of where she wanted to go, and her drive to get there. But then after that, like, we definitely have different kind of talents and some different kind of friends than I had back in the day when I was growing up in Houston. So I would say that's about where our similarities in. I also made her really tall because I always wanted to be really tall.
And you're not?
No, I mean, I'm 5'5". It's fine. But, like, oh, it'd be so great to be really tall and be like, I can play basketball. And,
and Piper plays basketball, too.
At concerts. But, yes, I made her tall because that's something I want.
And she... spends, you know, her friends are very important to her, and they are all artistic types as well.
Yes. And that is, I guess, another similarity. Most of my friends are visual artists or fine artists or writers, and I grew up around my mother owned a ceramic shop and was a potter, and so I grew up around ceramicists, both hobbyists in amateur level as well as people who were doing it for a living, and potters. And so I always kind of grew up around the arts, although I I can really appreciate them. I'm not great at executing them. I'm better at the text and writing. So I guess, again, a little wish fulfillment. But yeah, I wanted Piper to be surrounded with like-minded people, too. And even her family is very supportive of what she does in the book, but they don't necessarily understand it all. They're not... They support her because she likes doing this thing, but I don't know if they fully get how gifted and how good she really is.
No, I'm pretty sure they don't. Now, interestingly enough, I have three nieces who grew up in Conroe.
Oh, that's where my mother lives now. Yes, I know it well.
And all three of them are artists.
Interesting.
Yep.
That's not something you hear about all the time.
No. The oldest is a painter. She does pastels, oils, acrylics, so forth, mostly animal landscapes. So big focus on horses. She does a lot of portraits of horses and then animal landscapes, and she's very, very talented. The middle one does artistic photography. She also does wedding photography.
Oh, you pay the bills.
Yep.
And it's time.
And woodworking.
Oh, definitely a necessary craft. Yes. That's a great skill to have.
Yes. And the youngest, and they're all in their 20s, and they are all working artists. And the youngest is got a degree in ceramics, BFA, focused on ceramics from University of North Texas in Denton.
Oh, that's a great school in Denton. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
You have a very talented family.
Yes. And she works for one of my companies as a designer. So
cool.
She's able to, I hired her right out of college, and she knows how lucky she is to have actually gotten a job out of college where she gets to draw all day.
I mean, don't rub it. I'm sure that when they tell their friends, all three of them are working and doing what they want. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, yeah.
That's pretty great.
So I'm definitely going to pass this book on to the youngest one in particular, and I think she'll identify a bit with Piper. So you said you studied theater, but did you also always have in the back of your mind that you wanted to write?
Definitely. And when I was studying theater, at first, my entree into it was the same way that a lot of young theater artists are. I liked the acting part, and I was drawn to that. And then I was really, more and more, the more that I acted, the more I realized I don't care about the acting, I care about the stories more. And so I was more interested in the writing of the scripts and the rewriting, and then also directing as well. I really like the stage picture element. When directing is really telling the story visually. And so for me, it became very natural to study directing and study writing. And as I was studying playwriting and learning how to write plays and writing them, it didn't really occur to me exactly at that moment, but I was reading novels all the time. And I had been reading novels since I was a young kid, and it was always my love. I think I just kind of was like, well, if I'm in theater, I don't have time to write novels. I guess I didn't put it together that I could. And I started, I would write short stories, I'd write poetry, I'd kind of dabble in and out of a lot of different things. And I was definitely a jack of all trades. I kind of liked everything, but I wasn't trying to be the best at one thing. And playwriting was the most natural form for me. Playwriting and I just kind of fit together hand in glove. So I kept playwriting. And then when I was out of school and after internships and a lot of work throughout New York City and writing plays throughout the whole time, I kind of wanted to try other things. And suddenly I went from like somebody who's a jogger who's like, I want to try and run 3K, to like, I want to try and run a marathon. I'm going to try and write a novel. And that's a very different form, and it takes a very long time. And you have to kind of know why. Like, it's not so much I want to write a novel as I want to write a story. What story do I want to tell, and why do I want to tell this story? And so for a while it was like, well, I could try and write a novel, but I don't think I had a story to tell. I think it was like, can I do it? Can I figure out how to do it? So I wrote three novels that I kind of stashed away because I didn't like them. I still don't like them particularly, but I taught myself how to do it. And then with Piper, I have a writing group out here. I now live in Los Angeles, and I have a writing group I work with. And I was telling them, I said, you know, I really want to write a novel that's like a journal, like a diary, because I also write in a diary, and I've been doing that since the fourth grade. And I said, I want it to be from the perspective of a high school senior. And I know she's lives in Texas, and I just want to document a year of her life, and that's it. And I want to see if I can make it into a book. And they're like, go for it. Try it out. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work. So I started it, and before I knew it, Piper had taken over. And I was kind of like, oh, I guess I am writing Piper, whoever she is, and then figuring out what she wants and where she wants to go and what her life is. And excuse me. To me, through a character more than a story.
Really. So you really started with a single character.
I really did. It's the old playwright. Like, it's my sneaky way of putting a little playwriting in the book, I guess. Like, here's this girl. She desperately wants to get to New York. I have to find out why. I have to figure out what's not going to let her. And I have to hope I can get her there. And that was my goal. And then I started writing it 30 minutes a day. That was my cap. And so I could have the rest of my life and do the rest of the work I needed to do. And then at the end of the year, I had 365 pages, or 383 pages of a book, of a first draft. And I was like, okay, now I think I like this. I'm going to revise it and try and send it out in the world and see if anybody else likes it too.
Now, did you write it chronologically?
I did. I wrote it every day. The times and the dates that are listed in the book, mm-hmm. The book is kind of divided into chapters by month. But each month has its daily entries. And most of the time that is listed is when I was actually writing. Except for sometimes there's like she writes at 3 in the morning because she's had a late night out. Well, I did not have a late night out.
You're not a high school senior.
No, not for a long time. So, you know, sometimes I was writing at 8:30 in the morning, but the past three entries were at 8:30 in the morning. So I was like, okay, well, she needs writing. And also, she's on a class schedule. I was on a work schedule. So certainly, I need to make sure she was either in Spanish class or skipping a class or, you know, at recess or whatever I had her doing so that we knew where she was in that, because it's written in a journal, so I'm not constantly saying, you know, today in the gym, this happened. Today at the house, this happened. Mm. So because it's first person, past tense. So it's always kind of reporting on what just happened or maybe what happened a day or two before. So the time frame kind of sets up the structure, and we followed her day by day through that.
And the days were the actual days that you were writing?
Oh, yeah. Like February 3rd is a Super Bowl day, the year that I was writing this. And I was like, well, Piper and her family are watching the Super Bowl. Let's just figure this one out. Because I was like, what happens in real life? You know, and then you don't avoid birthdays. You don't avoid holidays. These are things that really can enrich kind of the texture of her life, too.
Mm-hmm.
And it was fun for me to build scenes around them.
Wow. And how did the other characters show up for you?
The first character that showed up besides Piper was her best friend, Kit. And then the very first page, Kit's full name is Katrina Bash, but she goes by Kit. And Kit was the closest ally and best friend, because you can't have a high school girl without a best friend in my world. I'm like, you've got to have somebody. And Kit immediately, I was like, Kit's much cooler than Piper, but she doesn't know it, and Piper doesn't know it either. Kit immediately, and Kit, to me, was the more grounded, almost likable version, because it's Piper's journal, and we often see Piper, we see Piper's point of view the whole time, and Piper doesn't know anyone's reading her journal. Piper can be pretty strong-minded and not always particularly nice in the way she evaluates things, but when she sees other people, especially people she loves, like Kit, then we get to see kind of their great qualities through her eyes.
Mm.
And the next person who arrived after Kit was her other best friend slash ex-boyfriend named Enzo, because Kit and Piper are talking about Enzo. And by the way, when I was writing them, I really was like, well, I guess there's a character named Enzo. And as soon as I would write their name down, I would then kind of brainstorm and go off on a different page and start writing out who they were and what their life was and why they were in this. And there were plenty of characters that were cut as well. There was even a dog that I had put in there because I love dogs. It never really made any sense. So I was like, all right, Bailey gets the cut.
Oh.
Yeah, poor Bailey. But.
Poor Bailey. Bailey is my grand dog.
Oh, now I feel extra bad.
It's a boxer.
Oh, little Bailey.
Yep.
Yeah, so they just kind of started a writing. I knew that she was going to have an issue with a sibling. Oftentimes, and I know it's thematically what I deal with a lot, when I'm writing younger characters, which is what I used to do more with playwriting and now in novels, I almost always have their central conflict with their siblings.
Mm. And why is that?
I mean, part of it is definitely me working my own stuff out, my own sibling issues.
Uh-oh.
I'm fascinated with it. You know, there's been all these studies in the last 10 years that siblings are truly supposed to be the ones that we're closest to, if we have them, because we live with them the longest amount of time, even longer traditionally than our parents, if nothing, you know, if no tragedy has struck or anything like that.
Yeah.
And that there are other storytellers in our lives. So when your parents may pass on, the people who remember the events, usually, if you live in the same house with them and if you have a closeness with them, are the sibling. And they are the other storyteller in your life. And I've always found that very fascinating, just like we're the storyteller of their life, and we may have a very different story than what they have of themselves and vice versa. And I'm compelled by that constantly. I don't think I'll ever honestly let that go, even if I'm writing about older siblings at some point.
That's really interesting.
And I'm not a twin, but I used to think, oh, to share this brain and to see the same story from different points of view, I'm fascinated with that. So I knew that her biggest antagonist would be her sister. It doesn't happen all the time, but there's a lot of young adult writing where the parent is the natural enemy. And part of that is like the teenager is building their independence and leaving home in a contemporary novel. But I really didn't want to make the parents the enemies. They are not perfect, and they are faulted, and they have some issues that I wish they would course correct. But they're pretty good parents. They do the best they can, and they make a fair amount of mistakes. But they didn't want them to be the evil villains.
Right.
You know, they're not.
Right, and they're not. They're not.
No. I kind of wish they would step up and take some responsibilities when they need to, but we're all human. So I try to, like, ingratiate them with that as well.
Now, Piper's sister has more than a normal amount of issues.
Yeah. I'm very careful with her sister's name is Marley, and I'm very careful with the way I describe her because my publisher, my editor, and I know what we have diagnosed her with and how we work her through that with her. But I really didn't want to give a clear definition for a couple of reasons, one of them being that I think a lot of people who deal with a person in their family with mental illness don't always have the ability to get a clear answer or the clear diagnosis or the clear medication that would help them have a more normal life. And I know that there's a lot of mental health awareness now, and that there's a lot of people who do get help, and that's the great part of the story. But for those who are around the situation, who are suffering, and who don't always have the answers and maybe not the skills and or not the money to afford help, and or maybe there's another issue like a family pride where they don't talk about it or anything like that, I really wanted to address what happens when the problem is not solved and when the character is not solved and how the family continues in that orbit around that character or that person. It's important to me to see and to have teenagers and young readers who read this to go, oh, yeah, I feel stuck like that, too. I feel trapped like that, too. I want to get away from my situation, too. And not go, oh, you mean it always gets fixed? Well, that's funny. In my life, it doesn't get fixed. I think some young people don't get the happy ending.
Right.
The ribbon at the end.
Yeah.
And I know that when I was younger and I was having some issues with one of my siblings, it was a moment of, like, I felt like what I wanted was for someone to tell me the truth, that maybe it doesn't get better, but it gets better by my own actions. And that, for me, means getting away. Mm. That doesn't mean they're going to ever be fixed so that I feel better.
Wow.
So it was important to me to leave it a little open-ended with Marley, that she's not a monster at the end of the book, but she definitely had made Piper's life pretty intolerable for a long, long time. And that sometimes, not all the time, and I don't want to be a pessimist, but sometimes people keep existing with their problems, and they can't, they don't get the help they need, and they don't change. And so.
And it's interesting because, like you said before, Piper doesn't come off looking that great in how she treats her sister either.
No, no. And that's the other thing. I love when people bring that up because in comparison, Piper might look like the ideal sister, but Piper's not ideal. She's problematic. She's a procrastinator. She's got flaws up and down the map. However, in comparison, they'll say, and I don't think it's just something parents do. I think communities do this. They label one kid the bad kid and one the good kid. Or like, oh, those are those sisters who always have drama going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in comparison, like, I would want to defend Piper and go, well, she's dealing with a lot. But you know what? Piper's not a wimp, and she kind of gives back when she can. And she does feel under threat, and she does feel, I think, underpowered compared to her sister. But she's not 100% blameless in the way the family treats her. I do think Piper's the only one who wants to confront the issues more.
Right.
The family. But right. I don't think, because she doesn't even get the help to confront, I think she's like, well, screwed. If you guys aren't going to help me out, then I'm certainly not going to back down.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's interesting, but I always feel like, well, Piper's not the excellent sister. I mean, she's a sister, but she's not perfect.
You're listening to Writers' Voices. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me today is Kayla Kagan, author of Piper Parish. Cool name. Where'd that come from?
So originally the book was going to be called Every Damn Day because I was writing it every damn day. Every damn day. And then we were like, well, that's probably not the way to sell a young adult book. But the title before Piper Parish was The Pieces of Piper Parish, meaning her art pieces and the pieces of her life that she kind of tries to puzzle together constantly. And then we were like, that's a little too alliterative, even though I like it. And then the publisher and my editor really liked just her name because Piper is so kind of self-focused and it is her journal, and everything about this is Piper. So they're like, what about just going with her name, Piper Parish? And I really liked it. I was like, I guess I was overlooking the pretty easy step there.
And how did you name her to begin with?
You know, Piper came to me first, and I have to be honest, like, Piper's not my favorite name. Like, I like it, but I don't know why it came to me. And then Parish, because it can mean decay and rot and everything else, I kind of thought, well, that's a cool teen name. Like, that's a cool, like, Parish. Like, she could be in a band. She could be goth. It's kind of new. And if it had changed by the end of the book and had become Piper Jones, I would have gone with it. But it just kind of stuck. And the more I said it, the more it felt right. And lately, I've had a few people point out, like, well, there's the Pied Piper in the talk of the Pied Piper and Parish in the Bible, and I didn't put that together. But I was like, oh, maybe my subconscious was doing something there. I really wasn't aware of that. But, so her name came, and then her name became the title and took over.
So you said you wrote on this, you wrote basically throughout a school year or through an entire year?
An entire year. It was 2013.
Okay.
And there's a poet that I really like named Robert Hass, H-A-S-S, and he has a quote that became my mantra, which was, take the time to write. You can do your life's work in half an hour a day. And I've said this quote often because just like if you're building anything, and I don't necessarily think it has to be writing, but a lot of people think, well, if I can't sit down and do this task for 4 to 8 hours a day, then I'm not a writer, or I'm not a performer, I'm not whatever it is that you want to pursue. And I kind of thought, well, in little chunks, you're still getting a page written, or maybe 2 pages written, or maybe half a page, depends. But it sets you in that act. So I determined that for a year I would write 30 minutes a day, whether it was total garbage, and trust me, there was plenty of garbage, or whether I was like cruising through it and like, oh, I can't wait till the next day. I really want to write my 30 pages or my 30 minutes right now. sometimes the best part was leaving off in the middle of a sentence.
I was going to say, so what if you were really on a roll? You still stuck to
it? I stopped myself because there's no better way to start writing the next day. Like, it's like having the best dessert and then you can't finish it and you have leftovers and you can't wait until the next day to eat it. Oh, I can't wait. Like, this is so great. The worst part is when you finish a section and you loved it and you're like, well, I don't know where to go from here.
Mm.
Like, oh, well, I just achieved the only great part of this book I've ever written. So now I'm, and that part is really the next day. It feels a little bit like trudge work. Like, you write the date and the time of her journal entry and then you're like, well, what do you have to tell me today? Like, what are you doing today? Why am I writing this journal entry right now and not later?
Well, you said you did not know where the story was going when you started.
No. My only goal and hope was to get her to New York.
And
I knew I didn't want her to... I didn't want page... whatever the last page was. I didn't want the last page and the last entry be on the first day that we started this. So I really wanted it. I said, okay, I'm going to put her in Texas. She may not end in New York, but I want to try and get her there.
Mm.
And we'll find out where she goes from there.
Is there a follow-up in the works?
So, without giving anything away, there is a sequel going on, and I'm revising it right now and have to turn it into my editor very soon.
Oh, my goodness.
There will be a sequel that comes out in the spring of 2018.
So, Kayla, you know, after you had your first draft after a year, then did you continue sticking with the half-hour day during the revision process, or did you step it up?
Not so much because it became... First, it felt like a little bit of an accomplishment just to get through writing a first novel that I felt kind of proud of and kind of felt like, oh, this might be something. Like, let's pursue it. So in the revising process, because I had this writing group that I would go to, what I was doing is I was writing every day in a journal, transcribing the pages into my laptop and sending them the pages so that we could discuss them when we workshop with each other. And throughout the year, I had been getting notes from them, and some I was incorporating and some I was holding on just because of either time constraints or because I wasn't sure about the notes. So the next part, the revising, was kind of going through the notes and going through and it sounds really simple, but like checking for typos and going through and fixing story points and taking out things that never really worked or added up to more than when I had started writing about them. So that was kind of on and off for a few months before I decided to query and send it out in the world and see if anyone liked it, any agents were interested in. So that was about 3 months of, like, some days I would try to work an hour or two. Sometimes I had a little more, a little less time. It just depended on what was going on. I was doing social media work for the LA Times at that point. So my time was much more dedicated to working for someone else than for myself. But once we got it in a draft form that I thought was strong enough to send out, I crafted a query letter, and I sent it to the top 5 agents that I was interested in. That whole thing about you get 100 rejection letters before you get a novel sold, it is true if you don't query smartly. There's so many people I could have queried that I know they were going to say no to because they weren't looking for a contemporary young adult book. So I feel like I want to tell writers, like, be really, really select with who you query.
Well, how did you do that research to find out who you should query?
A lot of times, if there's authors that you already like who are writing in that genre, you can go online and kind of trace who their agents are. Either sometimes they thank them publicly. Sometimes you can see it at the end of their books if you have their book on hand. Sometimes in their Twitter profile, they'll have their agent information. So it's just researching, kind of Googling names and seeing where they were at, and or going to the bookstore or the library and checking out the book again and going, who was, oh, she thanked her agent at this agency. Maybe they're still together. Maybe I can go on the web now and find that agent and see if they're open to queries. So there's a good 6 months or so of just narrowing down where you think you're the best match.
Mm.
And I think a lot of times, and I've heard this from a lot of friends who are like, well, I have a sci-fi book and I'm going to send it to this person and this person. I'm like, but they don't represent sci-fi and they don't like reading it. And they even said so on their website. So I think you're going to shoot yourself in the foot there. Like, go ahead and take the extra time and figure out so that you're not also getting tons of rejection slips because those hurt.
Yeah.
I sent out a novel a long, long time ago, and I made that mistake. That's why I'm saying it. It's not like, I've learned it hurts to get a bunch of rejections. However, when you kind of query, you know, just like, I guess, a dating site, like if you match yourself correctly, sometimes there can be some magic. And there were five I was really interested in. And the second one on my list, which wasn't in order of preference, just alphabetical, contacted me and I sent out a partial of my manuscript to her in a query letter, and she requested the full manuscript, and we started talking, and the next thing I knew, I was represented by her, and then she gave me more feedback and then more notes, and I rewrote a bunch. And then we send it out to editors and publishing houses.
And I understand it attracted quite a bit of attention at that point.
Yeah, it did. And I was super lucky. I had a really good agent at the time. She's still a wonderful person. She's no longer an agent. She's a film scout now. But I'm still at her agency with a different agent who I really like. And she took it out. And the first thing she said is, we have a preempt offer from a publisher. I didn't know what a preempt was. I was like, oh, what does that mean? And she said, they're going to offer you a certain amount of money, and you can say yes or no right away, but you only have 24 hours. And it doesn't matter if somebody else offers you after that. You've said yes. However, if we say no, they may not come back and offer again.
Oh.
So somebody who's never had to, like, play at that high-stakes level before, I was like, well, you never say no to money. I mean, no. And as a theater kid, like, who's grown up scrapping for jobs and hustling, I was like, you never say no. But I was like, but do you think anyone else will be interested? She's like, let's see. So then the next 2 to 3 days were finding out that five publishers were very interested and all starting to make offers. And then what happened was it went to auction, which was also new to me. And
wow.
So then I was lucky, and I had to choose between three wonderful publishers, and I got my first choice. So I was really lucky.
So you turned down the preempt offer? Is that?
I did.
Wow.
And by the way, that was maybe one of the hardest things I've ever done. Biting my nails, because I really thought, well, also,
it's a sure thing.
Turn down anyone who offers to publish, and what if they never offer again, and have I made a bad relationship happen now, and what if I'm choosing wrong, or what if I don't like any of the other offers, or what if there aren't any other offers? I mean, it could also then be like, well, you lost it, and you don't get another chance back at it. So I took a big risk. I trusted that she said there may be another offer out there, too. And she's been an agent for 9 years, so I kind of figured she knows what she's talking about.
Right.
Very nervous, and at the same time, I had an extremely high work level, high workload. So it was a real crazy week for me. A lot going on.
But it must have been very exciting. I mean, it sounds like once you got the agent and you worked with the agent for a number of months on polishing.
Yeah, about 2 months or so. She gave me some really great feedback and notes. And I think I took either all the notes or like 99% of them. And worked on polishing up the novel and getting it ready, and then she did her part of the job, which is taking it out.
Sounds like things happened pretty quickly from that point.
It felt like they did. I think she told me in July, early July, like, okay, this is the part where I take it out, and you won't hear from me for a bit, and then I'll let you know what we know. And about 2 weeks after that, she started calling.
Wow.
Saying, okay, we've got offers.
You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Kayla Kagan, author of Piper Parish, and it's published by Chronicle Books, which is one of my favorite publishers. We have quite a few Chronicle Book authors on Writers' Voices. They're the most beautiful books out there.
Absolutely are. Yeah. I'm absolutely thrilled to work with them, and I have to be honest, when I first got to talk to my editor there, who's wonderful, I was like, you know, I buy your note cards, I have journals, I have sketch pads and funny pencils from you guys, but I have to be honest, like, I don't know any of your novels. And they're like, well, we're building our young adult section out, and we have, you know, and there were a couple of adult titles I knew they had published, because I have them, and a couple of their cookbooks. But it became kind of this love affair with the editor, and they do such great work. And I had sketches and illustrations written throughout the book, and I said, you know, you're an art company. I was like, tell me that we'll be able to have an illustrator come on. I'm like, oh, yeah, of course. Like, we have plans for that.
I was going to ask you about that because throughout, you know, because it is in the form of a diary and written by an artist, she does have little doodles and sketches and things throughout.
She's
and
a scribbler like anyone else. This isn't her formal sketch pad where she might be using it to do pastels or watercolors or anything that she would want to use for people to see. But she definitely scribbles. She has ink blots and scratch outs and then a few sketches and a few kind of more drawn out pictures. But I really wanted to still feel like, well, these are the written words, but of course she's an artist, so it's visual. We want to see her work. So I thought that, hopefully they paired me with someone, with an illustrator that felt like Piper, and they pulled, they hired Maria Inez Gull, who is the head illustrator for Rookie Magazine, which is a magazine for young teens.
Mm.
We loved her work, and I was so excited that she agreed. And she's also doing the work for the sequel as well.
Wonderful.
So pretty thrilled about that. And it was great because I had written in with the journal entries, like a sketch here, a scratch out here, illustration of an Andy Warhol here, if possible. And I never knew if those would be able to be done or not. So,
now, that was another thing. Piper has quite a fascination with Andy Warhol, kind of an obsession.
She does, which a lot of people have asked me if I also have one.
Yes.
And I like Andy Warhol. I have no issue with Andy Warhol, obviously. But a lot of my friends who are artists in high school loved Andy Warhol. And that was our first entree into kind of knowing art on a big scale level of like, oh, it's a pop artist, and he's kind of fun and accessible, and maybe they didn't know his history, but a lot of my friends have said, oh, yeah, no, Andy Warhol, when you're 16, is a big one. And she's 18, but I feel like that's who she has set her sights on as the artist that she wants to be as big and powerful as him, and she likes his work, and she likes the pop of his art, and it's part of the reason she wants to go to New York City so bad. She wants to kind of trace steps of this person she idolizes.
And she loves his quotes.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And, you know, so he also kept a diary, and he also chronicled how much money he spent. And though she doesn't do it every time she goes out, she does write down money, like currency that she spends throughout here and there. And I think she basically kind of diaries probably because Andy diaried and journaled. And I think that's my secret tribute of like, oh yeah, his diaries, they're very everyday. Some of them are very boring entries. And they're fascinating because look who he became. And I've always been fascinated with thinking about what artists are like when they're teenagers. Like, what was Picasso like as a teenager? Who knows? Like, we know about his very young days. We know about when he was a young married man. But there's a lot of times that we get skipped over in history just because it hasn't been written down and we don't know. And I kind of imagine that in Piper's world as a fictional character, one day she may be a fantastic, huge artist. And I want there to be a little record in like her origin story of being an artist as a teenager.
Well, why don't you read us a little bit from Piper Parrish?
Oh, sure. I would love to. Okay, so I'm going to read from about two-thirds to three-fourths of the way into the book from the date of July 9th, which is her entry happens at 1:45 a.m. And just to give you a little quick tip, Katrina, also known as Kit, is her best friend, and her last name is Bash, and so Piper will be talking to her father throughout it. And Piper will also be talking a little bit with her friend Enzo and her brother-in-law to be kind of Ronnie, her sister's boyfriend. July 9th, 1:45 a.m. Spent all day and night at work so I could avoid my house. Went to Kit's. Her dad told me that she and her mom had gone to Galveston for the day, then asked me if I was getting ready for my great big New York adventure. He told me about when he did his undergrad work at Columbia, how he had the time of his life, how if I made it north past 110th Street, and he smiled to himself when he said this, some kind of inside joke, that I should definitely go to Sylvia's for soul food when I got homesick. Mm. I don't plan on being homesick, I said. Not because I thought I would anyway, but now how could I get homesick if I never left? Sick of home? Yes. Homesick? No. I thought I wouldn't either, Dr. Bash said, but I swear I did. No matter how many fun parties you go to, no matter how busy your schedule, you always miss home. You always miss your place or people. I nodded so he would believe I believed him. You'll miss Katrina, he said. Of course, I said, and when really, how could I miss Kit when I knew I was staying here? She barely wanted to hang out with me now anyway. I missed her now more than I probably would if I was away. Will you tell her I stopped by? Sure, he said. Oh, and by the way, we have something for you, a graduation gift. Since I was stuck in the ER and we didn't get to see you on the big day, Kit's mother and I have been meaning to give this to you. Hold on. I waited at the front door while he went running around the kitchen. Here it is. Came back with a purple envelope. This will come in handy up there. Thanks, I said. He was making me too sad. Hey, Dr. Bash. Goodbye, Piper Jane. On the way home, I opened the envelope and read the card. Congratulations, graduate. Here's a little something to get you started. Inside, there were 5 clean, crisp $100 bills tucked in the card's pocket. Both Dr. Bash's wrote notes. We're so proud of you for making the leap to New York, Kit's mom wrote. We know this gift will probably seem excessive, but Kit's best friend deserves the world. We're so proud of you. With love, Roberta. And from Kit's dad, don't forget the little people. We know you're going to make a big splash of paint in the art world. I looked back and forth from the card to the money. $500 meant so much and so little at the same time. $500 was so much to hold in my hand, but it wouldn't make a dent in my tuition. I smelled the dollar bills like they would have some power over me. Nothing but stale paper. Totally powerless. I texted Enzo. Kent went all the way to Galveston to avoid me? He texted back. Her mom made her. It was her day off. Me. Kit hates Galveston. E. But he didn't. Her mom doesn't. Me. This is bull. Me. What are you doing? Want to paint? Enzo. Can't. At Rice doing orientation exercises with the parentals. By the way, the student body needs a total makeover. It's tragic. Get out, Kit. She'll text or call. Chill. Ta-ta. When I got back home, I grabbed my paints and headed to the garage. I painted in greens and silvers and coppers. I painted all night, not knowing what was going to be the result, just something with motion and energy, not static or frozen. Part of me felt weird, scared, not knowing what I was even hoping would come out on the canvas. But mostly I felt freaking free, excuse me. I was painting a pure Piper Parish this time. I was painting life. And it was swirling and circling on itself, tornado-like. My pulse took over. It took over and let me go at the same time. I was so in the zone that when Ronnie came out and asked me if I could turn the music down because Marley was trying to sleep, I spun around and flung paint onto his shirt. I was sweaty and exhausted. The garage floor was covered in paint, and Ronnie took a step back. I'm so sorry, I was out of breath. It's cool, Ronnie smiled, looking down at the green slash of paint across his stomach. You should see you. You're a mess, girl. Here, blot your shirt, I said, handing him one of Dad's tool towels and my almost empty can of turpentine. Dab some of this on, too. Then take it off and put it in the washer. Warm water, right away. It's really not a big deal, Ronnie said, turning down my music. Besides, one day this shirt might be worth something. He winked at me and then looked behind me at my canvas. What's that going to be, he asked. It looks like some sort of monster. I'm not sure, I said. Well, something's eating at you, Auntie P. Keep on working it out, girl. He walked back to the house, quietly whistling. I looked at my big monster piece, still wet, and pretended I wasn't scared. My head kept saying, figure this out, you can figure this out, you can still get to New York. But the rest of me was crying. When I caught a glimpse of myself in the mirror by Mom's unused treadmill, I was covered in green. Monster green, envy green, money green.
And this was in July, so it's after she's graduated and
yes.
Still trying to figure out how to get to New York.
Yes, and she she thought she had it figured out, and then she found out she didn't have it figured out, not the way she thought. So some more work on her end is still needed.
Now, all of these kids are fashionistas.
Yes, they think they are. There's part of me that was like, I wonder if I saw their outfits now, if I'd be like, oh, that's not as good as you think. But they love thrift stores. They love putting together their own looks. They're fans of Project Runway and Project Runway Junior. And I think for Houston and for the way they hang out with each other and their artists, I think they think outside the box and they like to have fun with their clothes and, you know, kind of show who they are through their fashion.
And do you express yourself through fashion?
You know, when I was Piper's age and when I was in high school and college, I was so much more fearless with my clothing. I'm like, well, is Old Navy having a sale? Great. I'll go get some tank tops. I'm a little more, I wouldn't say conservative, but I think I make much more boring choices than I used to. Because I used to be very fearless about, like, oh, if it didn't go together, great. I was going to put it on just to, like, show people that I could, and I wasn't worried about it. And now I'm like, well, everything mixes and matches. It's fine. I think, again, it's maybe a little wish fulfillment of, like, oh, remember how great it was to go and, like, buy a vest for a quarter and throw it on and be like, I have the best look in town.
Ah. Now, is this book, is Piper Parish set in current time?
It is set in current time, and part of the issue that I had with it, like, a lot of things that are set currently, when there's a problem, you can usually solve it by Googling it.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried really hard to keep the internet out of it as much as I could in terms of problem solving. But it faces a challenge because there is, like, the real quick, easy step is like, well, why wouldn't you look that up online? Well, because then you don't have a story, or you have a really quick story. So, and it ends a lot sooner. So that was a little challenging to kind of pull that out a little bit.
Yeah, and it's interesting because technology changes so fast that stories become dated very quickly.
Oh, yeah, and that's the other thing. Let's say I name Instagram or Twitter or Snapchat in this, you know, by the time, and the way that publishing works is kind of slow compared to how technology works. So let's say the sequel I'm writing right now, if I name drop a bunch of apps or tech companies, in 2 years, let's assume they're still running, you know, but who knows if they actually are by the time the book would come out. And I actually had one incident that happened that wasn't a technology-based incident, but all of the locations that are in the book are Houston places, except for one, and that is the 610 Diner, which
is in Austin.
Well, in the 610 Diner, there may be one in Austin.
Yeah.
The diner it was based on is a diner in Houston called the 59 Diner. And it was the 59 Diner until we went to print. When the day before, my husband showed me an article, the 59 Diner was closing all locations because the owners, well, I don't know exactly what happened, but the owners owed the employees a bunch of money they didn't pay. And there were some legal issues. And then I found out they were all closing. I was like, oh, my gosh, this book, there's so much that happens in this diner. There's a very influential place in Houston, and a lot of people know. And if it's still the same name, when it comes out, they're going to know how dated this is. So at the last minute, we had to change it. And the 59 Diner is like the 59 Highway, so we just chose the 610 Highway. And
wow.
It was one of those things like, well, it's a good catch, but who, you know, you don't always think that those things are going to change. And then, surprise.
Yeah, really. So, Kayla, are you now like a full-time novelist, or are you still a playwright? Are you still involved in theater?
I am still doing a little playwriting right now. I have a couple of short pieces in monologue books that are coming out later this year. But I'm mostly working on the sequel and focusing on that, and kind of had to stop doing the social media jobs for this year because I've been traveling a whole lot and would not be able to keep the commitments to my employer. So could not do that. But right now, full-time noveling, which is something I never thought I would be able to do in my life, and hopefully I'll be able to keep doing it next year as well. But Yeah, for this year at least. I'm full time.
Now, would this story have worked as a play?
You know, wow, that's such a good question. Yes, if you took out a bunch of the elements that were kind of like B-plot kind of stuff. A lot of people have asked me, have the movie rights been sold? And, you know, and I, the weird thing is to me, and I understand why people ask that, the weird thing is that I've never seen this as a movie, and I'm a very visual person when it comes to production, not necessarily to fine arts, but I don't see it as a movie at all. So I was like, no, why would it be a movie? It's a novel. That's actually the complete form it's supposed to be in. But somebody brought up, well, what about a series, like a Netflix series or an Amazon series? And I was like, that I could see more easily.
Mm.
But a movie, no, it doesn't make any sense to me why this would be a movie. So with a play, I go, well, if we changed where, if we really focus on Piper and Marley with art as kind of the theme that runs through the book and not Piper and art as the major focus, I think we could make it a play.
Mm.
But I'm like, wow, I never actually never thought of it as a play either. So,
have you had plays that have been fully produced?
I have a weird little niche that I'm in. I write a lot of short plays for high schoolers and college students, and they're kind of produced all over the scene all the time. And I used to have, when I lived in New York, I had professional productions. Like, oftentimes theater companies would put four of my short plays together and make it an hour, or like a night of one acts or a night of play readings. And then I had a couple of full lengths that were produced as well there. So, yeah, but strangely, like, I get emails from, like, Boise State. They're like, hey, we're doing one of your plays and we have questions for you. I'm like, great, tell me all about it.
Wow. It must
be
really...
I love hearing that they're actually being done and kind of all over. And I got a student from Australia the other day who they're putting on a show there, and he's like, I don't know how royalties work. What do I do? How do I pay? I was like, don't worry about it. Tell me what are you doing and what shows. And it's fun to hear that that's...
It must be interesting to actually see your work performed, because, particularly if you aren't involved in the production at all.
Oh, yeah. It's super weird. I mean, it's almost like a relief when you're not... in the rehearsal process, because then you're like, well, I have no responsibility for whatever may come. But however, if it's amazing and they've done a great job, you're like, well, I was involved. Those are my words.
Yeah.
Only want to take credit. But no, I mean, it's weird because I feel the director side of me come out when I'm in a rehearsal where I naturally want to take over. But that's kind of the worst thing you can do, because listening to the other artists, the other director who's been hired, and the actors who bring their own takes to your story, into now their story, it's invaluable, because you learn so much. You hear an actor read a line you never would have read that way, and you're like, oh my gosh, you understand the character so much better than I do. Your way. So it's kind of exciting. And right now, for the first time ever, I'm producing a show. Rabbit Hole is being done here in Los Angeles, which was on Broadway with Manhattan Theater Club back in New York. And I was a part of that is through that. I used to work at Manhattan Theater Club, and so the arts education department, we would do family matinees and study guides and things like that for it. And now there's a small theater company out here in Los Angeles who's doing it, and they brought me on as a producer, and it's very exciting to, like, pop in a rehearsal and see what they're doing. And I love the script, so I love seeing it.
So you're still involved in theater?
I am, yeah. When I first came out here, I joined a theater company, and it had 10 other playwrights in it, and we were supposed to be just development and workshop with each other, but then we started producing. We did a really fun kind of satire on Paula Deen, which was really, really fun. And we had characters that were sticks of butter. It was really wild. I loved it. But everybody's busy with other projects, so we haven't had a chance to meet in a long time. But, yeah, I definitely keep my foot there. It's my home. That's my comfort.
Now, what about making the leap to screenwriting?
Well, so the big secret is I'm married to a screenwriter.
Uh-huh.
And I see his work, and I see how hard he works. And I don't know if I have it in me. But, I mean, do I have storytelling in me that would be fun to write for the screenwriting world? Yes. But Hollywood is such a different game, and it's I don't put it down at all, but it's a game I don't know if I'm strong enough to play, and he is, and he also focuses on young adult stuff, so he's had two movies that have come out that have done pretty well, and he's still like, wow, it's a hard business, like it's a challenge. So
is that how you ended up in LA?
It is, yeah. Yes. We were living in Manhattan, but he was working out here more and more, and his managers and his agents were asking him to come out because the more he was out here, the more meetings he was having, and he was booking gigs, and we had lived in Manhattan. I was there 12 years. He was there 11 years, and we just kind of decided to give it a shot. We were like, if we absolutely hate it, we'll come back to Brooklyn, and we'll just go on living our life the way we have. And we had friends out there, and his family's in nearby Connecticut. And it turned out we really liked it. And I know it's really flaky to say it, but the weather here really does make a difference.
Yeah, really. So, but you grew up in warm weather.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So do you still have family in Houston?
I do. I was just there earlier this week. I was just there on coming back on Tuesday. And my mother's still there. I have a brother who lives out in they live on opposite sides of Houston in different areas. My mom's now out in the Conroe area. My brother is out in the Gonzales area. And then I have other family who's kind of spread out through the United States. But everyone started in Texas, and a few remain. And my aunt and uncle and cousins are out in Houston as well. So
Piper Parish is out in the bookstores now. And the sequel is coming out in a year. Right?
In a year, spring 2018. I don't know the exact month or day, but sometime in spring.
And then will you continue with Piper beyond that, or will you move on to another character?
I think so. I'm pretty sure we're wrapping Piper up with this book. I will be and I will get to work immediately. But I think we're going to wrap her up and on to new stories.
And still for young adults? Are you sticking with young adults?
I hope so. Yeah, that's my plan. I have a couple of ideas boiling that I'm very eager to jump on. And as soon as revisions are over on this book, then I will be working on those.
But well, I'm really excited to. I look forward to seeing what those will be. And
well, I want to start talking about them, but I won't because
I know. Just real quickly, 30 seconds. What kind of response have you gotten from young readers so far?
Oh my gosh, super fun. People who immediately connect with her and or go, wow, Piper seems like she could be really annoying at first, but now I love her. And also a lot of readers are saying, I wouldn't want anyone to ever read my diaries and read my journals. And I go, I know, because they're private. Piper never knew these were going to be read out loud. So
yeah.
That's why they are the way they are. But they like her, and they think she's funny.
They identify with her.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Kayla, thank you so much for being with us on Writer's Voices today.
Oh, it was really an honor. This has been so great. Oh. I really, really appreciate it.
And usually my mother does a closing quote, but I'm going to do one from the book by Andy Warhol. They always say time changes things, but you actually have to change them yourself.
Oh, I love it.
And we will be if you're listening to us on Friday, this will be broadcast Monday morning at 8 a.m. It will also be up on the website eventually, writersvoices.com. And also on Friday, if you're listening stay tuned for Planet Erstwhile with James Moore. If you're listening on Monday morning, have a great week and see you next week on Writer's Voices. Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline is a production of KRUU LP 100.1 FM.